This is the Wheeler Center podcast.
Hello, welcome.
I'm Sarah Krasenstein. I'm a writer, a lawyer, and the author of The Trauma Cleaner. I have the delight not only of welcoming you here today for the next hour in which we get to hear from Helen, one of our greatest writers, but of welcoming you to Broadside 2019, which as a punter and a Melbourneite, I'm extremely grateful for. 2 days of great programming from our beloved Wheeler Center. Helen and I are going to chat for about 45 minutes, and then I'm going to hand over to you guys for 10 to 15 minutes of questions. Some housekeeping first. Books that have already been signed by Helen will be available in the Broadside bookstore run by Neighborhood Books for purchase after our session. It's fine to do all your social media things, but please make sure your phones are on silent. Hashtag Broadside2019 and at Wheeler Center. Please don't video record the event. Pictures are fine as long as you get us from our favorite angles and ensure that we're well lit. And we're all literary festival people, so you'll understand why I'm about to ask you with the questions. One question per person. Keep it short, and please, for the love of God, phrase it in the form of a question. All righty. Okay. It feels, because it is false, to introduce an internationally acclaimed, multi-award-winning author who has published significant works across a range of genres since and before 1977, and who is regularly referred to as a national treasure. But for anyone who blindly followed all the hordes into the hall today thinking there might be free beer, I'll just say you're in for a treat. It's more appropriate to start the session by introducing Helen's newest book, Yellow Notebook, volume one of her diaries, which spans from 1978, just after Monkey Grip, her first book, was published, to 1987, 4 books and 2 screenplays later, when she had established and was continuing to build a substantial body of work. Many people keep diaries. What makes the enterprise writerly are the twin compulsions of one, moving a pen across a page, and two, collecting and storing, like wood for the winter, a steady accumulation of lived detail. This is done above all for its own sake, but for the writer it is also secondarily and vitally important for their work. It's a bit about refining technique, one's skill at ordering words on the page, as Helen puts it in here, the space to practice and not perform. It's a lot about harvesting and preserving living detail from the world. Above all, though, perhaps, it's about trying to find a measure of distance from that which cannot be distanced. It's about fearless self-scrutiny, the first step towards fulfilling the writer's duty, which demands the nerve to be accountable on the open page. The Yellow Notebook is a thing of wonder, a deeply intimate dialogue with the self, a magic window that for many will be a mirror. It is comprised of snapshots of self-contained worlds, which together point towards the whole, the making of a heavyweight champion. These snapshots are diamonds, the things one can think but not say, the moments of clarity and beauty that can feel with a twist of the light as though they never existed at all. How joy in the work sits alongside a self-eviscerating doubt that is the constant companion of creation. It is also the story of a woman embedded in the calling world, which is to say it is about a profound reverence for that world at the same time as it's about solitude and guilt, which are part of the job description. A pulling away from the world in order to pull material from it and keep a version of it alive in one's head. All this is here alongside the highest wisdom that books are not begun when one sits down at a desk. Books are begun in the act of noticing and preserving, when one pins down a fat, bone-colored moon, the skier on the TV in a cafe, the dampness of a borrowed boot, the life that could have been lived. Books are made out of all the moments of one's interior and exterior life, which one salvages and brings to the business of understanding the world and writing about how it is and could be. Please welcome Helen Garner.
Thank you. Thanks.
When did you start keeping a diary? I know it doesn't start with 1977.
No, because I burnt all this stuff up until then. I probably started when I was a teenager, because I come from a big family, and I'm the eldest of the family, and I was always trying to get away and find a quiet spot. And I liked notebooks and pens, and I always have. And one thing about a diary is that you can use them every day.
Yeah.
And I just used to, there was a shed in our backyard, and I found this horrible old sort of little tiny room at the back, which some bloke had probably had his little tool shed out there. And I thought, oh, this could be a nice place to bring my notebook and pencil or pen. And I went out there, and I don't remember actually writing anything when I was there, but I just sat there, and it was so peaceful. Yeah. It's a privacy thing.
How that practice, in terms of how frequently you were writing and what you were writing, did it change over time?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I actually started actually putting something on the page. Yeah, and I burnt everything when I went to university, of course, because I didn't want my mother to read it. And I just chucked it, you know, in those days you're allowed to burn things majorly in your backyard. And so we had this huge conflagration, and my mother was standing there going, let me read just one page. And I said, no, not a single page. And so, you know, that's the first lot. That was my big burning in 1961. Yeah.
Oh, God. As my Nana would say, no good deed goes unpunished. Now that we've got this, people will be wanting more. They'll want to know, you know, what was cut out. They'll want to know what you wrote before that, when the next one's coming out. Can you tell us a little bit about this process, like the emotional process of making something that was private into something that is going to be and has started already to be public property?
Well, I cut a lot. Obviously, when you're just writing for yourself, you're trying to. Well, I'll say I, because I don't know how other people do this, but it seems to me that writing a diary is a lot to do with it's a technical practice, and so I'm always interested in writing proper sentences and practicing that. And I can't remember what the question was that you asked me. Sorry.
So, process of...
Oh, yeah, of actually preparing it for publication. Okay. Well, so I went back, and I'd burnt a lot of stuff up until around the time that this diary starts. That was another great conflagration I had. And I thought, well, around about the time I was in Paris with my daughter, we lived there briefly when she was about 8. And around about that point of the diary, it started to me to get more interesting to me retrospectively. And I thought, well, I'll just start there. So I had the notebooks here and I started typing it onto the computer. And every time I saw a little interesting bit, I copied that down. You know, I mean, it's a simple process.
Yeah.
But I suppose that when you read the first part of this diary, it's very bitty and fragmentary, and in fact the whole thing, it consists of a series of fragments. But I think the fragments get more substantial as the book goes on. There was a lot of boring stuff in there, you know, stuff that I think would bore other people. Naturally, I found it fascinating. But but no, seriously, to think what other people might find interesting about your, you know, dialogue with yourself is actually quite a challenging process.
I think that, you know, particularly when you write nonfiction, certain types of fiction, people are hungry for, you know, that grain of authenticity, and they want to know, is it true? Who's writing this? And want to know all about them. So I don't know that they would find much boring. In terms of that kind of detail selection, one of the things that is hardest about writing, I think it doesn't matter whether it's fiction or nonfiction, but is translating, you know, the mountain of undifferentiated information that is life into the story of life. Yeah. So when you'd sit down to kind of write about your day, was that process of, you know, elevating something above all the rest easier or harder when you had access to, you know, all of the information, like, from your life?
Well, that's what I mean. There are some days when I write for a long time, and some days I might only write for 5 minutes, but it's a habit that I've got now, and it's a habit that helps me to basically not crack up. I think, as you say, there's this cataract of information coming at you, and I think writers are the kinds of people who, as Joan Didion calls, she says that writers are lonely, anxious rearrangers of things. And that has a lot to do with this, I think, that if you feel that if you can just get it into words and arrange it in sentence form on the page, it will perhaps be less troubling or will hurt less or will make you feel less of a beast of what you did that day. It's not just what people did to you, it's what you did to other people on that day. And that's actually brings me to the painful side of publishing a diary, which is seeing how awful you've been. I mean, it's not a document of self praise. It's a document of sort of struggling to not be a bitch, you know, not to. Yeah, and that's the other thing about a diary, going back over it, there's nowhere to hide. I mean, I can cut. I agreed with myself at the beginning that I would cut because there was just too much of it, so I had to cut. But the criteria for cutting, I thought I wouldn't rewrite. If there was something clumsily expressed, I'd have to leave it there. And the only things that I would change would be if it was meaningless to another person. I mean, if I'd left out a crucial factor or, you know, I'd written sloppily on that day. But the thing that's missing in a published diary is a voiceover. Yeah. So if you're writing memoir, it's... what I'm saying is that a diary is composed entirely of voice, contemporaneous voice at the time that when you were writing it. And there's nothing... And when you publish a diary, you don't give yourself permission to say, well, you know, back in 1979, I did that. Mm-hmm. I did that then, but no way would I do anything like that now because I'm much nicer. And so there's no voiceover that's going to kind of gloss over your crimes and sort of retrospectively justify your behaviour. And I found that actually quite an excruciating process. I really had to kind of force myself to put things in. And one reason why I put them in was that this is another process that happened during the year or so that I, year and a half that took me to pull this together, was that I, not only was I rereading my own diaries, but I was, you know, living an ordinary life. I was reading novels and books and I was seeing movies and listening to my friends talking and seeing things on TV. And I thought, I came to the point where the stuff that I was writing down, it stopped being kind of lacerating to me. Yeah. And I had this terrific sense of comradeliness with the rest of the human race. I thought, I'm not unique. None of this is unique. I actually must at this point give praise to my editor, Jane Pearson, who when I would go down the gurgler saying, I can't publish this stuff, it's horrible. And she'd say quietly, Helen, this could be anybody's marriage breaking down. It's not, she didn't say it's not unique. That's what I'm saying. And that was the wonderful thing that I found, that we all hurt each other and we all are hurt. And we go around the world hurting each other and being hurt. And then there's all the other stuff that happens, like we love each other or our children come up with some wonderful observation that redeems the whole year of your life with its freshness and beauty and tolerance. And I found all those things came to me in a big flood. And so that's why by the time I came up with the actual document at the end, the manuscript, I thought, well, this is not so terrible after all. And I think that people might feel comradely with me when they read it, and they might see their own life in it. And a bloke interviewed me last week for a newspaper, and he said at the beginning, he said, I want to tell you what my favourite sentence is, Helen, in this whole book. After mowing, I raked. And... And at that moment, I thought, oh, I'm going to love this interview. But he was an older guy. You know, he wasn't one of those behind-the-ears guys who looks like if Jeff's stepped out of a nightclub and haven't read your book, although they're pretending to it when they interview you. No, this guy was... And I told that to one of my sisters. I said, you know, how much I loved that remark, and I thought it was actually... I mean, it hadn't occurred... I was talking about mowing the grass up at this place, this shack I used to have up in the bush, and my dad taught me how to use the motor mower, and I was really thrilled that I could use it. So, I wrote this after mowing I raked, thinking it was just a statement of fact of something that I did. And the journalist picked up on that as... something to do with the whole process of the diary making, I suppose, and the publication of the diary. And my sister said, yes, and after raking, you have to winnow. And you have to look at what you've raked up and pick out what's worth keeping and what's worth burning or getting rid of. So, and I was very happy about that journalist.
I think that, you know, that calculus of what to share, how much to share, and then, you know, the terror about having it out there has only the opposite impact of what the fear is saying. It's the more vulnerable you are, the rawer you are, particularly about human weaknesses, human failings, it only has the impact of connecting with the reader more, because I think that's what vulnerability does.
Well, that's what I'm hoping, and you know, some people have said things to me that made me think that maybe that's true.
Yes. Didion again has surfaced, and I have another Didion question just in case for later. She wrote that style is character, and by
who way, said who said this?
Joan Didion. Style is character, by which I understand her to be meaning that, you know, she's refusing to wholly conflate the first-person voice in any work with the name on the front of the book. So we choose to put on our vulnerability, or we put on our you know, insights. And I always thought of that in opposition to Virginia Woolf saying, you know, you've got to tell the truth about yourself before you can tell the truth about anyone else. And to me, Yellow Notebook slots in seamlessly with the rest of your work, where you subject yourself to that same unflinching gaze that you cast over the material. And it seems it's a kind of an ethical or energetic contract that, you know, you will be clear-eyed about others in the world in the same way that you will be clear-eyed about yourself, for better or worse. Did that come any easier when it was just yourself as the audience on the page, or was that with those disclosures of, you know, yes, it's for yourself, but it's still external to you now? Was that kind of training for how to do it in public?
Yeah, I suppose it was. It wasn't my aim, but I guess it did work out that way. Oh, you see, I'm not 100% sure that deal stands up in court. That if I, you know, I look at whatever it is I'm looking at and writing about, and I say things that other people perhaps wish that I wouldn't say, and to say, yeah, but I say a lot of stuff about myself that I wish that wouldn't be true too, and as if those two things balance up, and I'm not at all sure about that. I think that in nonfiction and obviously now with diary writing and memoir, that you can be seen as, well, I was going to say playing fast and loose with other people's experience. I'm suddenly thinking of years ago, a guy that I knew that had known at university. I had lunch with him one day. Nice guy. I'd never known him well. And this was back in the 70s when I was, you know, a sort of rather prim feminist. You know, I was against makeup and things like that and wore overalls, and which I still do. But be that as it may, this guy and I had lunch together, and afterwards he wrote a short story about it, and it was called Monologue with Interruptions. And the person, the ear basher, was me. And, I mean, you know, I don't know if everyone else knew who the story was about. But I was rather stung by it, but I thought, well, yeah, it's probably a pretty accurate assessment of our encounter. But the thing that really shit me about it was that he said I was wearing a blouse or a shirt that was unbuttoned down here and my breasts were showing. I thought, that is not possible. There is no way that I would have worn such a shirt in those days. And I was quite mortified by that. But you see, I didn't care about all the stuff that he was basically saying. This woman, he bashed me for 2 hours and here's what she said. But it was just that one thing that seemed to me to strike the wrong note about my prim personality. And I was quite furious with it. But, you know, I didn't say anything. Well, I mean, you know, who am I to complain about that? Also, he's dead now. God bless him. He was a really nice guy. Stop laughing.
Okay. Doesn't really... One of the things that I love best about this book is what you show but don't explain or say overtly, which is writing anyway. You know, you don't wait for ideal conditions to sit down and you know, do the work that you are in the middle of the books that you get done during the span of this book. You know, it's not ideal physical conditions or not ideal mental or emotional conditions. And was that a discipline that you learned over time, or was it just an impulse that was just natural and it was just, you know, little effort because you couldn't help but do it?
That's mother discipline. Mm. When you've got a child, if the child goes to sleep, you sit down and do some work. Or when the child goes to school, you get on your bike and you ride to the library and you work there until 3 o'clock in the afternoon when you go to pick up the child. You have to learn to use the time that's given to you. And it can be terribly frustrating, and the awfulness of having a sick child is... your secret rage that the child is sick because you're trying, but you love the child and the child needs caring for, and you do it.
Yes.
But what I did find, though, was at those times of not being able to work, your unconscious is still working away if you've got some project on the boil. And I've noticed this over the years, and other people have said the same thing to me, how much work you actually do while you're asleep. I mean, you go to sleep and you think, oh, God, well, how the hell can I make those two things fit together? And in despair, you fall asleep. And you wake up in the morning and something's happened in the night. And you sit down and you go, oh, I get it. But I don't know how that happens. It's a sort of miracle. But I'm a great believer in the unconscious. I think it does a hell of a lot of heavy lifting.
Yeah, unfortunately not all of the work, but you know, very important. I think the impulse, particularly if... You know, you're attracted to reading and writing in notebooks. You have a particular kind of personality. You do appreciate discipline and completeness. And the impulse, at least for me, is sometimes, if it's not working, to do it harder, just to sit there, not get up, don't go to the loo, just do it harder, harder, harder. Mm. When actually, if you take the breathing room and you go for a walk and you leave it alone, things start to surface.
There's a late psychoanalyst woman in England called Marion Milner, and I've read quite a bit of her work over the years. And she, there's a book of hers called An Experiment, I think it's called An Experiment in Leisure. And it's a lot of it is about her own processes that she learnt to use when she was writing and working. And it sounds really wacko, but it really works. She said, you know, when I'm stuck with something, I'm sitting in front of a piece of work and I just can't make it move, and nothing will come on the paper from what's in my head. She said, what I do is I don't try to force it, and I don't get up and walk around the room or go and do the washing. She says, I just sit there and I say to myself, I am nothing. I have nothing. I want nothing. And she said, I just sit there in that moment of non-existence. And something after a little while begins to stir. And when I first read that, I thought, oh, bullshit, that can't be true. Because I was that sort of person who thinks that force is everything. And But I thought, well, I'm going to try that. And I tried it. And it's not like you come out with a whole novel or something. You might come out with one sentence that experience. But one sentence is better than not one sentence, isn't it? And I think people are hard on themselves. I think as a writer, and especially as a mother, you've got to set yourself up a working structure, structure time. And I mean, you know, like everybody in my generation, you know, we thought that, God, what did we think? That, you know, there was this thing called inspiration and it just swept over you and suddenly you were sitting down pouring out this manuscript. And, of course, that's all bullshit. And it's a wonderful thing to accept that it is and to know that you do a thing little by little and you work as hard as you can until you're exhausted and then you stop. But you don't have to drive yourself past that point. And if you do, that's when you start writing badly.
Yeah. I mean, I think that point about motherhood or anyone that's got, you know, caretaking responsibilities or another kind of big part of the life, it really puts a lot of what's written about, you know, the conventional wisdom about the writer's routine and, you know, the writing prompts and both. It's the moment when you realize you should be so lucky to complain about the writing being the hard part, you know, getting to the desk is the hard part. Mm-hmm. So when you're at the desk, you kind of treat that time differently than if you had just infinite flexibility, I think. But yeah, it doesn't mean that the lightness is not still open to you of being able to use the time in different ways. And I mean, I think something like collecting the inspiration when you see it, you know, consciously or unconsciously, is part of that. You're writing all the time anyway.
But it doesn't feel like inspiration.
No.
It just feels like you see something interesting and you think, oh, I'll have a go at that.
Yeah.
I just threw out all ideas of inspiration years ago. It's all just noticing. You've got to walk around the world looking at things and listening and paying attention.
Noticing, but also, I think, curiosity. I mean, the impulse underlying the noticing, because, you know, life can beat you down and you lose the curious impulse, you lose the interest at times. And so when it comes back again and you are driven to notice and appreciating what's before you, I mean, I think that's part of it as well, the desire to notice.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you see, the wonderful thing about getting older is that you can strike up conversations with any stranger because they think, oh, who's this old duck? And and so, you know, I sit down on a train or a tram and whoever's next to me, I'm just completely shameless now. And, you know, because you're old, a bloke's not going to think you're hitting on him or anything. And you can just, it's just amazing what people will tell you. The other thing I've noticed about conversations with strangers is they're not really conversations, that the other person very rarely asks me a question. but that's okay because I just want to hear their story or I just want to see the way their face changes when they talk. And I think, too, that those moments with strangers, they make you realise how rare it is that someone listens to you for a long time. I used to go to I rent this little office near the Royal Melbourne Hospital, and there's a really good cafeteria there at the hospital, and I go there and get a sandwich at lunchtime, and instead of taking the sandwich back to work, I just sit down at a table with all the patients, basically, and everybody there is in a state of anxiety and something. You know, either they're all plastered up or they've just had a baby or their daughter's just about to have a baby and everything's maybe going pear-shaped and people are frightened and sore and they've got plaster on their arms. And you can say, you sit down at the table and you go, oh, what happened to your arm? And they'll tell you. Or they'll tell you the whole story of their family. And I'm really good at just listening. I mean, I never take notes. I rush away later and write it down. Those things are just incredibly precious to me, things that people tell me, strangers tell me on trams. And I just love public transport for that reason.
Does it have something in common with the access to information? Obviously, it's a different quality of information, different context, but what's available in court reporting?
Oh, yeah, courts are just these places of power and grief, but they're places of stories. And actually, I used to notice when I'd walk into that cafeteria to get my lunch, I noticed after a while that I would get this little adrenaline buzz when I walked in there, and then I connected it with the adrenaline rush that I get when I walk into a court. Yeah, yeah. It's the same thing, walking into a public arena where people are going through awful experiences, painful, scary experiences, and you know, as a stranger, you walk in there, and you learn to conduct yourself in those places unobtrusively, and whole universes of human experience and suffering and hope and rage and despair just open out in front of you. And because in a court, they're played out in a highly formalised way.
Yeah.
I can hardly walk. I just don't get off the train at Flagstaff anymore because I just can't hold back from going back in there. And it seemed to me that finding out about courts and the law was one of the best things that ever happened to me.
Did it come as a surprise, that kind of dropping into it? I'm thinking about how you started off in schools, which were one form of institution, and the idea that you would end up kind of not just immersing yourself, but being such a talented observer of the exchange of information and the public meeting, the private, that occurs in the courts, which is another institution. Would you imagine the kind of, am I right to say, love that you have for that work?
Well, I think the difference with being a teacher is you've got to go in there and get control of what's going on. You walk in. I remember that when I was first teaching at Werribee High School in 1967, the classes I didn't even have a dip ed, you know. I mean, in those days, they'd hire you as a teacher if you had one university subject. You know, I'm serious. When I rock up to the education department as I come out of Melbourne University with a third class honours degree in English and French, useless degree, and I didn't know what to do, so I rock up to the education department and I say, oh, I was wondering if I could get a job as a teacher. And they go, oh, yeah, have you got any qualifications? I go, no, I haven't got a dip ed. And they say, have you been to uni? I go, yes, actually, I've got an honours degree from Melbourne University. And, you know, their face lights up. Because, I mean, if I'd said, look, I've got two subjects, they would have hired me. That's how desperate people were. And so they say, okay, you can have Werribee or Witchy Proof. So I thought I should have gone to Witchy Proof because that's up in the Mallee. That's where my dad came from. But anyway, then I would have stupidly, you know, married a farmer, and then I would have had a whole lot of different problems, but like drought. but anyway, what was I going to say about Werribee? Yeah, so you walk into this classroom and there's 42 kids in there writing, and I didn't know how to control a class. You know, when I was at the education department, I said, they said, well, okay, I said, well, how am I going to manage? Because I don't actually know how to teach people. And I said, the guy actually said to me, he said, well, look, just think back to when you were in high school, and just remember how your teachers taught. Okay. So, you know, it took me 6 months to get the whip hand, but that's an unfortunate expression. But it took me 6 months to stop being terrified and to realise that I just adored these kids, and that we were going to be laughing from 9 o'clock in the morning till 3:30 in the afternoon and working together. And, yeah, I loved it, but that's very different from the courts. I mean, in the court, I walk in and I try to make myself this mouse-like person. I just sit there and I'm sucking in everything I can see and hear, but now it's different because now I know a lot of judges and I know a lot of lawyers, and that's a different thing. But when I first I went into a court recently thinking I was going to write about this particular case I'd read about in the paper, and I sat down in the press seats, and I was sort of at right angles to the bar table, and this was before the the judge had come in, and I was looking along the table to see who was appearing for this unfortunate girl, and I saw that it was Peter Morrissey, who was the guy who appeared for Robert Farquharson. In other words, I had sat in courts near him for 7 years and then published this book in which, you know, he was his, a losing case. And he leaned forward at the bar table just at the moment when I leaned forward to see who was at that bar table. And our eyes met and we both became convulsed with mad laughter. It was such a weird thing. I mean, he was covering his face. And anyway, later, later after the whole thing, the day's work was over, I went to say hello and he got out his phone and said, guess what, I've just got remarried. Do you want to see a picture of my wife? And so, you know, that's the sort of thing that happens in courts. But it's a bit different from a school.
I think in terms of moving through different worlds that have their own language and their own rules and, you know, whether it's the court system or even a court case or other people's lives, it's a question of always being slightly uncomfortable. I mean, you learn how to, you know, take on the cloak of, you know, the uniform in that particular milieu fairly quickly. But is there always a sense of active kind of discomfort or awkwardness that keeps you kind of live to the detail?
You mean actually in the court or when I'm trying to write about the court?
I mean, when you're trying to write about anything.
Ah. Yeah. Because... Oh, there's about 1,000 things I could say in answer to that. When I'm actually sitting at the table writing, I don't feel uncomfortable. I might feel frustrated and panic-stricken and enraged and things like that, and with this huge sense that I have no accumulated competence, which is something that happens at the beginning of everything I write. It's in between times, you know, thinking about what I want to write. That's the uncomfortable part. And waking up at 2 o'clock in the morning and asking myself if I've actually got the right to do this. See, it took me ages going to courts. I used to, like most people, I didn't realise that you were allowed to go into a court, that anybody can go in and sit there, because it's a democracy, you know, of course you can. But I used to think any minute now somebody would tap me on the shoulder and say, what are you doing in here? Get out. And I still a weeny bit feel like that.
Yeah.
But, No, actually sitting there, one thing I do know how to do is put a sentence together. And I've been practicing, you know, what that Malcolm Gladwell thing where he says you have to do to get really good at something, you've got to do 10,000 hours of it. Well, that's one thing that a diary is useful. That really stacks up the hours. And if you take it seriously, I mean, I'm imagining there are some people here who are writers or, you know, just starting out, that it's practice. It's like a musical instrument. You can't just sit down at the table. You can't just sit down at the piano and play a Rachmaninoff concerto. You've got to do the hard yards. And the same with writing. You have to actually read and read and read and then... look at how other people do it. You know, look at their how they make a sentence work. I'm actually quite horrified by some of the books that I read that are being published now that look as if no editor has been anywhere near them, and the writer is flailing away there alone, not noticing that she has. That she has got no idea about how to attach a subordinate clause to the main clause and not to have 20 other clauses hanging off the end with the life force leaking out of every joint. This is something that really worries me, and I think it's partly of my generation of teachers. We didn't teach grammar. So when I was at school, we learnt grammar. Strictly, we learnt grammar and syntax, and we learnt how you put a sentence together. And you learnt how to take a sentence apart, see how it worked, and then put it back together. But that's gone. It's gone. And I mean, my grandchildren can't even handwrite, you know. I mean, they're just... Anyway... I won't get started on that, but I do feel a terrible loss of... Because if someone doesn't know anything about grammar, I mean, even the most primitive understanding of how a sentence is put together, it means it's very difficult to criticise your own work. I mean, with what tools do you look at the problem, attack the problems of your own clumsy sentences if you don't know that, you know, you can't have 14 adverbs in a paragraph without everything going to shit? You know, it's... And I feel great sadness with this. And I have been, once I was writer in residence up at Newcastle, and that was when I twigged that the people in my class didn't know any grammar. You know, I was saying, see all those adverbs in there? And their little faces would go pale with terror. And I said to them one day, did you actually learn any grammar in high school? And they sort of went, no. I said, well, do you know the parts of speech? And I said, for example, what is a verb? And around this university classroom ran this whisper, a verb is a doing word. And I thought, oh my God, I'm going to have to go right back to the start. But they were craving to be taught this. They said, well, can you teach us? I mean, people I know, younger writers, have said to me, teach me some grammar. Can you teach me some? It's terrible. It's a terrible loss.
Yeah. I mean, reading everything forever, your whole life, prepares you in a way, but it's also this false kind of sense of confidence, because it's like learning a language. Unless you can sit there and read and, you know, think you know, but unless you get out there and you're doing it, you realize you don't know anything.
Yeah.
Doing it on the page, I think. I'm going to read out the whole quote because I love it so much. Philip Roth wrote in American Pastoral, "The fact remains that getting people right is not what living is all about anyway. It's about getting them wrong that is living. Getting them wrong and wrong and wrong, and then on careful reconsideration, getting them wrong again. That's how we know we're alive. We're wrong." I'm thinking about the difference between factual and emotional memory, and not in the sense like, oh, our memory plays tricks on us, but more in the sense that we're just inevitably always partial, subjective. We only just see our perspective. Do you reckon going back and revisiting the earlier diaries that we're unreliable narrators of ourselves in a way that matters? Like, I know that we are.
Yeah, but I know what you're saying.
At the end of the day, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I think memory is obviously, it's a creative act. It's not just a matter of going to the filing cabinet, pulling out the drawer and looking something up and it's all written in there. It's our memories are constantly recreating the past, partly to make us look better to ourselves or make us feel better. And so actually going back and looking at your diaries is quite sort of bracing in that regard, because you come upon, for example, an incident that you might have told as a story over years to people, and you realise here's the nub of the thing which you wrote down on the day it happened with dialogue, and then you think, God, you know, 40 years later, I've changed that all around. And, you know, I was the bastard in the situation and not that guy. And the dialogue's all wrong. But I don't see the thing, there's any way out of that, out of the fact that we rewrite everything. You know, 5 minutes after it's happened, you've got a different version of it. And there doesn't seem to be any way out of that. So you do the best you can. That's why writers have to take notes.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, crudely stated. Yeah. You write things down as soon as they happen, just a word to remind you of something. Because everything is just fleeting, fleeting, fleeting. And the older I get, the more I feel that. And I notice that the diaries I write now are actually kind of ridiculous. I mean, they've still got bits in them that interest me if I flip back and look, but I write down all sorts of details that are of no interest to myself, like I mean, because I'm terrified I'm forgetting, I'm in my 70s now, and I can feel that ability slipping away. I think, oh, maybe I should write down that yesterday I planted the tomatoes, or, you know, that kind of thing, which really you don't need to write down, because if you didn't plant them, they're not going to grow. But it's really quite unnerving.
But is it kind of a version of what was there all along? I'm thinking about Philip Larkin, you know, we write out of an urge to preserve life.
Oh, yeah. All art is a, what does he say? Urge to preserve all is the art, basis of all art.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, I've felt that from a young age, like, I've got to get this down, I've got to get it for its own sake, and, you know, I take photos, I can't even erase the duplicates. I mean, this is kind of a relationship with reality in the sense of time passing that kind of, I guess, foregrounds exists before you create, you know, you think consciously, I'm going to write a book, or I want, you know, maybe it's something that's always there justifying why anyone would spend 7 years, you know, subjecting themselves to very emotional court case so that you can preserve something at the end of it of value. Maybe it's just the exaggeration of that, you know, as life progresses.
But and I don't know, writers are the kinds of people who are afraid of losing things, maybe. I mean, just in that Joan Didion thing, lonely, anxious rearrangers of things, that comes to mind so often. I think writers are often lonely, anxious people. I mean, you know, they can put on a bit of an act of being sociable, but really they're dying to get away and write down what you just said.
It's true. All right, we've got time for one more, for me to do one more, and then we'll throw out to you guys. One of the things that I was very aware of reading The Notebook was that while we get a new kind of expansive view of your interior landscape, the voice was very familiar to me, and I think it will be familiar to readers. It's the same forensic eye for heartbreaking detail, and the lean lyricism, and kind of this willingness that, you know, you can trace throughout all of your works to make room for both ambiguity and discernment. I mean, that's very strong. Michael Hayward, who is our publisher, has said that there are a billion stories and novels in the diary just out of reach, but they are all really one story, and they're yours. So I'm wondering if all your books have been, in that same sense, one great book of Garner. The way in which The Notebook slots into that makes me curious whether in some way you've always been writing to yourself in terms of ideal audience.
In terms of an ideal audience? Well, what if I said yes? Would that make me a narcissist?
I don't think so.
Seriously.
I don't think so. Isn't the most narcissistic thing being like the all-seeing eye of God speaking to everybody in the world?
Oh, okay. All right. I'll relax about it. Well, I don't know. Well, I mean, I'm obviously my first reader, and I read sort of furiously. You know, I've got a very strongly developed sense of sort of disgust, I suppose, not about subject matter so much as tone. Tone is very crucial to me, and I think tone is character, by the way. But that's another.
I remember the comment about Mansfield's diary, the tone being sickly sweet, but the power behind the writing being very muscular.
Yeah.
The tone wrong, you lose the reader.
I think that used to happen a lot with women writers, that they felt like they had to tone themselves down, that they had to somehow, a feeling as a woman that you weren't. Well, I still have this sense that, and you know, this is embarrassing to say in front of a feminist audience, but I still have the feeling that I've only got a very limited amount of time of people's attention, and that's why I have to write short. And that's why I've got to boil it down, because I just want to get the story into such a form that the person's not going to go, oh, shit, I'm sick of this, and put the book down and walk away. I think that women taken a long time for women to be at ease in a public space. And I'm thinking of writing as a public space, that you know, you see those, well, I mean, Lucy Ellman's just blown that one out of the water. There's that book called Ducks Newburyport, which is like that fat. And I looked at that book and I thought, well, I'm going to read that book, but I would never write a book that was that big. I would think no one's going to read to the end of this book, and I couldn't stand it because, you know, I'm making all my perfect little sentences, and I'm thinking, you know, if nobody wants to read to the end, I really have to go and kill myself or something. But that's everything I write has to pass through that neurotic filter that I've just described.
Yes. Yeah. And are you the harshest critic of it?
Oh, no, I'm sure there's a lot more harsher critics, like Virginia Trioli.
All right.
God bless her.
When can we expect the next volume?
Oh, God, I don't know. It'll take me a while because there's some stuff coming up that I've got a technical problem. I've got a technical problem of how to move fast and light.
Yes.
And that's actually the sort of technical problem I really enjoy. I like to move fast, but not, this is in the diary somewhere, not to move fast, but not to be trapped in speed.
Yes.
That's quite hard to do, and that's what I'm trying to do, yeah.
Thank you. We will go out to audience questions now. I think.
Could you elaborate on daily or regular writing practices that you have found helpful or nuanced?
Regular writing practice.
Yeah, daily practice.
Oh, yeah. I wake up in the morning. The first thing I do is I pick up the pen. Oh, this is, I'm sitting up in bed, and I write in a diary. Maybe I had a dream, or I have a thought when I wake up and I write it down, or else I write down what I was too tired to write down the night before, and that might take 5 minutes or 20 minutes. Then I get up and I have my brekkie, and then I go to, this is if I'm actually working on a project. I rent this office, and I find that very useful because it means that I don't do a lot of housework things just as displacement activities. You know, it's really, if I used to try to work at home, I'd get up, have my brekkie, put on a load of washing, then I'd have to hang around and wait for the cycle to be over, and then I would hang it out on the line, and then it's morning tea time, and you know, you get the picture. So I go to my office, and there's nothing in there except a table and a chair and a shelf, and I've got this little mat where I can have a nap after lunch. So I go and get a sandwich at the hospital at lunchtime, and then I come back and have a little nap for about 10 minutes, and I've missed out all the work that I do in the morning. And I don't know if the questioner is interested in this, but I've discovered a technique of when I was writing about a court case, I would have a series of notebooks. I always want to pass this on because it's a really useful thing that I don't know if I discovered it, but this is what I do. That I have a notebook, a diary, which is basically, I write in it every day if I'm writing about, say, a trial. When I get home, I mean, I have the notebook where I'm writing down in the court, you know, what people say, and I've got the transcript, but there's this whole other mass of information that I've got and I have to, and which is sort of in my head. And so every day I write down faithfully and very enjoyably, I love doing it, an account of my engagement with the material. And by that, I mean, I'm saying, gee, I felt really excited today. I felt that I could sense who was telling the truth in this story and who wasn't, and this is why. And such and such had this kind of expression on his face, or I noticed the tears were running down that witness's face when she spoke. And I write down all that kind of stuff. And this is regular. I do it every day faithfully. And that adds up to this massive, brightly alive amount of information. It's a kind of treasure trove of information. And I often, and when I get to the point of actually trying to write the book, that is the richest information I've got. All the other stuff is kind of more technical, you know, it's transcript, it's just what happened in the court. But these notebooks, and I'm sure this idea of the running journal or notebook of your engagement with the material would probably work just as well with fiction. It has. I've used it in fiction as well. Because there's stuff in there that it doesn't really fit in any other box. But when I go back to it, I'm amazed at its richness and its detail. And it's all about detail. So it's like, yeah, I open up this box and it's jumping in there. You know, it's like you open up the compost heap and it's full of worms wriggling.
That's original detail. I mean,
yeah, the stuff that you note contemporaneously at the moment when the thing happened, and you write down and something you saw and what you thought about it or what you felt about it. Like, for example, in the court where the police were sitting, three angry policemen. And I just saw them sitting there, and I wrote down in my notebook, a dense wall of male power. And I'd forgotten about it. I'd forgotten it because, you know, they wear those tunics and they're sitting shoulder to shoulder. And I actually shared their anger at this point because their evidence was being disgracefully misrepresented. But just looking at just moments like that where you see something and an image comes to you on the spot, and it's the image that you need to save, and that's what you're going to use when you come to write the thing. So I don't know if that's any use to the questioner who I'm sorry I can't even see you.
What first took you into a courtroom?
What first took me to a courtroom? Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Curiosity. I had a friend whose stepdaughter had been murdered, and I knew the girl, and I wanted to know what happened to her. And it was horrible. And I said to him, "Can I come to the court with you?" And he said, "Why do you want to come?" And I said, "I thought you might need to have someone with you, and I'm curious." And it was really there. I mean, I did feel that with him. I knew that it was very traumatic for him, and I was a person who, you know, didn't have an ordinary job, so I was free in the daytime and I could go to the court. And, yeah, so I went. And, yeah, I learnt a lot. I learnt there that they really do have to prove it. You know, I would have personally torn those two accused persons limb from limb, but it had to be proved, and that was a very painful and unforgettable lesson that I learnt. So that's the thing that happened the first time I went, and it stayed with me always.
Anyone else?
Helen, have your views on feminism changed since the Me Too movement?
Since the Me Too movement? I couldn't say what my views of feminism are or were. I just know that feminism, when it hit me in the 70s, completely changed my life. It was like sticking my head up, and as if I'd been in underwater all my life, and I stuck my head out and took a breath and looked around, and it gave me a way to analyse things. I still feel that today. I've had various clashes with the movement over the years, but I still, you know, if anyone said to me, "Are you a feminist?" I'd say, "What do you think?" I'm a woman. I'm an intelligent woman who's lived 77 years in this world. Of course, I'm a feminist. But Me Too, like all movements of this kind, I mean, when it first started, I rejoiced. I thought, now these chickens are going to come home to roost. And then as it developed and became more complex, which is the case with all political movements, I found myself at times at odds with it, and at other times plunged back into that kind of rage that you feel as a woman when you hear what happens in this world and what people do and what men do. Some men do. I would say that these things keep on developing right in front of me in the world, and my feelings towards them change with every day, But I would strongly say that, yes, I was a feminist, and I don't know if that statement is of any use to anyone except me, but, and I don't know if that's an answer to your question, but there it is.
We've got time for one more.
I've got a question about sort of supervision, I guess, and you write a lot about trauma, and I wonder that if you're having some form of supervision because it's a debrief on the trauma that you're exposing yourself to, do you see that as a therapeutic process or is it part of the creative process?
Oh, okay, you know, that's an interesting question. No, I don't have any form of debriefing except just talking to people that I know. I don't... until quite recently, it wouldn't have occurred to me that I ever needed it. I thought, in the court, I would see the journalists there, the court reporters, and they seemed to me to have a handle on the thing that I didn't have. I mean, they knew how to. It seemed to me, they knew how to deal with the trauma that they were exposed to every day in the courts. And I was kind of going down the gurgler when I got home. I just thought I was a wimp. I thought I'm unprofessional, they're professionals, and I'm an amateur. That's the way I thought of it. But as the time went on, writing the book does enormously help because it means that I can get a handle on the thing and shape it and record it and feel that there was some point in recording it and shaping it. But... No, I have never had any kind of professional debriefing. It is very useful to talk to journalists and sometimes talk to cops, nurses, you know, people who have terrible jobs. And I've appreciated their company, but I've never got any sort of professional help, no. Oh, I'm sorry, that didn't really answer... Yeah, it did answer your question because I said actually writing the stuff, writing the book and shaping it is very... helpful. I wouldn't say it was therapeutic, but yeah.
Unfortunately, we have run out of time. Could you join me in thanking Helen for being so generous today?
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing, and ideas from Melbourne, Australia, and the world.